Greetings, friends. This is Dr. Mark Sharona, and I want to welcome you to The Edge podcast, where all things theological, psychological, spiritual, and cultural will be explored so that you and I might understand the times and know what to do about them. Enjoy. Friends, I'm delighted today that as you're listening to this podcast, you're going to get to hear a very prolific writer and a brilliant author. Her name is Kristen Dumay. She's an academic, and she has written a book called Jesus and John Wayne. And I'll let her talk more about that, including the subtitle on white evangelicalism. But I am really delighted that she was willing to sit with me in a podcast, because I tend to be one of those guys that academics don't quite know what to do with, but I am in the academic world, and I have read the book. I read it cover to cover twice and was deeply impacted by what Kristen had to share. And so, Kristen, I'm delighted that you're here today. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So let's talk a little bit about Kristen Dumay and her journey a little bit. Just give my audience an awareness of who you are, where you're from, and how you got to where you are.
Sure. So I'm a Midwesterner. I grew up in a small town in Iowa, a Dutch ethnic community. So I grew up, my dad was a theology professor and ordained minister in the Christian Reformed Church. And my mom was an immigrant from the Netherlands. And I kind of just grew up going to Christian schools, went off to Christian college, and then went off to graduate school at the University of Notre Dame, where I studied religious history and also was introduced to the study of women and gender. And from there, I ended up getting a job right out of graduate school at Calvin University in Michigan. And that's where I still teach. And I write at the intersection of gender, religion, and politics. My first book was A History of Christian Feminism, and then Jesus and John Wayne is my second book.
Well, I want to talk about Jesus and John Wayne because it's such a compelling book. I mean, from the very beginning. I mean, in your introduction, you start with talking a little bit about your background, but then you also talk about where all this stuff started. So you start with 2016 and you go from there. But what was it for you that caused you to feel like I need to write this now? What was it for you personally that moved you to do that?
So I had started looking into evangelical ideals of masculinity more than 15 years ago. And it was students from my class who brought to my attention the book Wild at Heart by John Eldridge. And they did because I had just taught about Teddy Roosevelt in my US history class and showed how he was embodying this very militant conception of white masculinity, and it was
rugged
like foreign
policy,
right, rugged individualism, and you know, use violence to bring order, and it was a very white patriarchy, and they just said, Professor Dumay, you have to read this book. And so I bought the book at Family Christian Bookstore, opened it up, and sure enough, there's a quote from Teddy Roosevelt right up front. And so I became really fascinated with this particularly militant strand of Christian masculinity that was all the rage in the early 2000s. This was also during the Iraq War. So I saw how, survey after survey showed how supportive evangelicals were of the Iraq War more than any other Americans. They condoned the use of torture, right? You had all these statistics. So I thought, you know, what might one of these things have to do with the other? And then I ended up setting the project aside for a very long time. I had other things going on. I had to finish my first book. I had three kids. And it wasn't until the fall of 2016 that I realized I needed to write this book. And it was actually the days after the Access Hollywood tape released, because I hadn't stopped paying attention to this militant masculinity over the years. And what I saw was one after another of the men who were promoting this became embroiled in scandal, abusive power or sex abuse. And so in the days after Access Hollywood released, when the whole world was basically asking, well, white evangelicals still support Donald Trump after all of this, I realized that, well, we saw that they did. they, a couple wavered ever so briefly. But we also what I noticed is the language that I heard evangelicals use to defend their support for Trump was exactly the same language that I had heard, that I had read in these books promoting this militant evangelical masculinity where the ends justify the means. And that's what I realized.
Errol Dockinger.
Yeah. So we need to, and that's when I realized I needed to write the book.
Wow. Well, as I read the book, you grabbed me from the first sentence, but I mean, as I read the book, every chapter built consecutively. And I felt like if I was in a boxing ring, I was getting pommeled until, you know, I definitely was dead by the time it was over. It was so compelling, but what I felt like while I was reading it was, oh my goodness, how much worse can this get? And like, just when I thought we had hit, okay, this is it. Then you go on and say, oh my goodness. And the thing I think for me, and where I'd like you to actually develop from the original point from Teddy Roosevelt on, a couple things that struck me. When Abraham Kuyper came to America, he was problematic in his doctrine, and he was challenged maybe I've got Bavinck and Kuyper confused, but one of them refused to meet with Teddy Roosevelt because of the nature of the toxicity, both in terms of the abuse of power and in terms of racism. Mm-hmm. And so it grabbed my attention that, you know, we probably haven't paid as, now I have been involved in the urban church for 48 years. So my whole world is the urban church. But I haven't been as attentive as perhaps I've needed to be of understanding the times in terms of the trajectory mm-hmm. of where masculinity has gone within the context of the white evangelical church. And so I wasn't as aware as I needed to be from what you shared. So when you think about where Teddy Roosevelt was in history, and then what came from that, why do you suppose he was such a pivotal figure in all of this?
Yeah, so it's not a direct line from Teddy Roosevelt to the present. What I noticed simply is that Teddy Roosevelt was one of evangelicals' favorite heroes to look back okay. to, right? This kind of mythical hero. And it wasn't just Teddy Roosevelt, although he was a favorite, appeared in all sorts of different books on how to be a Christian man. They loved him for his ruggedness. He knew how to wield power, and so he was a favorite, but so was, you know, Mel Gibson's William Wallace from the movie Braveheart. Yeah. They're a huge favorite. Yeah. General Patton, General MacArthur, yeah. You know, John Wayne from the title of my book. These were the kinds of guys that evangelicals were looking to inspire them in, you know, what does it mean to be a Christian man? And what I came to see is, you know, you mentioned race, and I thought I was setting out to write a book about gender, and very quickly I realized I was also writing a book about race, because this militant Christian masculinity was always a white masculinity, right? The heroes were all white men, and they were often white men who proved their heroic masculinity by subduing non-white populations. I mean, think of nearly every role John Wayne played on screen, defeating the Native Americans, the Mexicans.
Yep.
Yeah, the Mexicans, the Japanese, the Vietnamese. And so that's a kind of consistent strand. And what I came to see is that this militant conception of evangelical masculinity is tightly linked to Christian nationalism, all right, into white Christian nationalism, the idea that you need to defend faith, family, and nation.
So when let's talk about that in terms of the National Association of Evangelicals and where that plays into all that.
Yeah, so the National Association of Evangelicals formed in 1942, and they were coming together not because evangelicals had completely disappeared. You know, that's kind of the standard narrative after the Scopes trial in the 1920s, evangelicals were just done for until all of a sudden they reemerged. They didn't disappear, but they just invested in their own institutions and their own churches and organizations. And then in 1942, they came together and said, you know, just think of what we could accomplish if we did band together. And if we had magazines with subscriptions in the tens of thousands, and if we had, you know, organizations for our Bible colleges, and if we took to the radio, and they did all of this. It was really remarkable. And Billy Graham was really at the center of this. And so the National Association of Evangelicals just kind of symbolizes this rebirth of evangelicalism that on the one hand kind of sets themselves against the extreme fundamentalists. They're much more kind of culturally engaged, but at the same time, very much promoting these conservative ideals of gender traditionalism and militarism and Christian nationalism, particularly, you know, during World War II is when they form. And then immediately after, we're in the throes of the Cold War. And that was a really formative era for conservative white evangelicals culturally and politically.
And then you go on to tell the story of an LA entertainer cowboy that everybody was singing his songs. I've even sung his songs over the years. I'm a musician as well. But talk about that and how that ties into how it affected evangelicalism and even how Billy Graham was impacted by him. Stuart Hamblin.
Yeah, Stuart Hamblin. And I pick up the story with Billy Graham's Los Angeles Crusade and this wonderful story there of Stuart Hamblin who comes to Christ. And it's just this great symbol of what is to come. Because here we have this, singing cowboy. We have the combination of this kind of Western individualism, this Hollywood motif. And you have this kind of melding of secular culture with evangelicalism. And Stuart Hamblin doesn't have to abandon his singing career, right? He can continue to do what he's doing. He does give up smoking and drinking, and but he can continue to be this cowboy singer and also to be a Christian. And that's where we kind of see this combination of evangelicals coming out of the shadows and really embracing popular culture and embracing celebrity culture. And of course, Billy Graham is the biggest celebrity in the evangelical orbit. But you see this kind of cultural engagement, not just transforming culture, but really taking on secular culture and embracing that and being transformed by it.
Talk about that, being transformed by it. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So, when evangelicals talk about themselves, they self-identify as Bible-believing Christians, right? That's who they are. They'll identify as that before they even identify as evangelical oftentimes. And there is a commitment to the scriptures, but that self-identification does obscure the fact that evangelicals have also been deeply influenced by modern culture and by secular values. And so if you take this ideal of masculinity, you can just see how this conservative ideal of kind of John Wayne masculinity became extremely popular in the 1960s and 1970s. And it became a kind of political identifier. John Wayne, both in his actual person and his on-screen persona, represented the rejection of the 1960s, of hippies, the rejection of feminism and also of civil rights. And he kind of came to embody this. Evangelicals, in embracing this kind of militant conception of masculinity, were drawn to secular heroes, right? To these mythical heroes, to this on-screen persona. And in doing so, by calling that Christian manhood, by saying that this is how God has called men to be, they end up transforming Christianity itself, right? They end up recreating the Jesus of the Gospels in the image of this kind of warrior who will do what needs to be done, who will use violence to achieve order and to pursue righteousness. And so in many ways, it's kind of this embrace of an unbiblical or secular masculinity that fuels a militancy within Christianity that really undercuts some of the core gospel teachings, like love your neighbor as yourself. Turn the other cheek, love your enemies, or we could just, you know, list the fruit of the spirit or recite the Beatitudes. And these are core biblical teachings that get set aside, get explicitly dismissed, saying, no, that doesn't apply. Not in this moment.
Yeah. And it's interesting because the the psychological dynamic of embracing that requires ignoring. John Wayne was a womanizer. I mean, he had multiple affairs. He had many wives. His family relationship, even with his children, wasn't that great. But why do you suppose? Why do you suppose all of that would be ignored? What goes on inside the psyche that that gets ignored in favor of let's weaponize the cross?
Yeah. You know, as I was researching and writing this book, I really did feel like I was coming up against the limits of my historical discipline. And I really wanted to pass the baton to psychologists more than once here, because you're right. I think, you know, I can explain, I can describe what happened internally, understanding what's really at play. I can only go so far. One of the things I can say is, you know, to understand how evangelicals could, you know, give somebody like John Wayne a pass, but, you know, more recently, somebody like Donald Trump a pass when it came to personal morality, sexual morality, there, you really have to take a close look at evangelical views of sexuality. And this kind of sexual double standard, the idea that, you know, men are filled with testosterone, that's the way God made them. He made them to be aggressive and he designed them this way so that they can fulfill their role as leaders. And you need to protect that aggression and protect it against feminism and the emasculation of modern culture and liberalism and all these things, right? So that's where the focus is. And women, on the other hand, need to submit to men, and they need to also satisfy them sexually, really to contain their sexual drive within heterosexual marriage. And they need to protect virtue by not tempting men who are not their husbands through modesty and this kind of purity culture, and then by sexually fulfilling their husbands in every possible way so that their husbands don't go outside of marriage to satiate their needs. And I mean, this seems kind of extreme when I'm just saying it like this. This is pervasive in evangelical sex guides, right? And evangelicals write a lot of books on sexuality, and they read a lot of books on sexuality. And going back decades, this is the message that you're going to get. So what that means is if a man goes astray, there is always a woman to blame. A woman who tempted him, a woman who seduced him, a wife who was not meeting his needs. And again, this sounds just awful. And it is horrifying when you read this. And at first I thought, okay, this is a, you know, I'd come across one instance and another, and they felt like horrific outliers. And then I had to, at a certain point, accept that this is not, you know, a situation of outliers. These are repeated patterns over decades, where there is always a woman to blame. And so the man ends up, you know, getting protected, getting defended. You need to protect, you know, if it's a pastor, you need to protect the witness or the man's ministry. You need to protect the witness of the church. There's always these excuses ready and waiting for male perpetrators. And it's the victim who gets blamed over and over again, even if that victim is just a child.
Yeah. And I mean, I have a degree in psychology as well as theology, but I mean, there are so many dynamics to this that, psychology itself has been condemned in many evangelical circles as psychobabble. When the psyche, I mean, we can go back in church history and look at how the early church and the patristics and their progenitors, how they understood the human psyche. We don't talk about this stuff much. And so there are, to me, so many issues that the book triggered that I think require a whole lot of soul searching. Yeah. My prayer is that the men that read it, as well as the women, would really pay attention and come to a place of realization. This is not healthy. I mean, and we've seen, even recently, we've seen all the scandal over Mars Hill and all of that stuff. And but it seems to be something that is not going away.
No.
And it seems to be getting even more entrenched. When you think about where we were in the 40s, You look at the arc of history, and then where things got in the 70s, where now I'm a product of a late baby boomer. So John, was it Tom Wolfe who said we were the me generation, you know, and when we were the narcissists. But I mean, that's even gotten more pronounced now. So let's talk a little bit then about moving from, because John Wayne becomes this cultural icon that that is larger than life. And how is it that John Wayne becomes this pivotal figure for the evangelical movement? How does that happen? Where does that start? How does that happen? And because it's fascinating to me.
Well, I think he first becomes this iconic figure simply for white conservatives. That, you know, in the 1960s in particular, he emerges as this figure who stands for quote unquote traditional American values, right? He's against feminism. He's against civil rights. He's openly racist.
He is very open. It is
right.
No,
yeah, yeah, let's not skip over that fact. And again, on screen, so he in his films, especially, you know, from the 1960s on, he symbolizes this rejection of the 1960s counterculture. And so he becomes the symbol, not just for evangelicals and not first for evangelicals, I think it's fair to say. He became a symbol simply for conservative Republicans. And this is just during the time that we see this partisan realignment, when we really see the birth of the modern Republican Party as we recognize it today, where you have white Southerners moving from the Democratic Party into the Republican Party, part of the Southern strategy, right? And race and racism is right at the center of that. Absolutely. And you see evangelicals increasingly aligning, moving as well, particularly Southern evangelicals from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party. And they are uniting not just around a set of policies, but they are also uniting around an identity, this cultural identity, right? That we stand for quote unquote traditional values, that we reject these modern changes. And John Wayne was just, you know, the favorite symbol, not just for the cultural identity, but then he in his own person was active in the Republican Party, right? He was a supporter of Barry Goldwater, of Phyllis Schlafly, and especially of Ronald Reagan. So he and Ronald Reagan, good friends, they appeared together, right? About John Wayne, you know, campaigned for Reagan. And so came to symbolize really this shift through this cultural identity that, you know, traditional values voters were drawn to him, and evangelicals were front and center among that group.
And talk a little bit about Barry Goldwater. There may be some of our younger audience that aren't familiar enough with what happened in the 60s with Barry Goldwater.
Yeah, in 1964. So Barry Goldwater, a very extremist candidate at that time, and who ardent kind of Cold War, anti-communist candidate, very harsh and very extreme, and he ended up being defeated. And actually most evangelicals didn't end up voting for Barry Goldwater, but a pretty solid core of, you know, evangelicals on the kind of further right end of the spectrum were drawn to him, were drawn to his militancy, were drawn to this, his kind of cowboy posture. He was not afraid to draw. And that's what was needed, according to Goldwater and according to many conservative evangelicals, in that moment in the Cold War, right? With an enemy like communism, communists were anti-God, anti-family, and anti-American, and evangelical politics have really coalesced around this anti-communism. And so Barry Goldwater kind of stood in as this extreme candidate. He went down in defeat. He was too extreme in that moment, but he really ended up being a kind of harbinger for what was to come. And the appeal only grew over time. I mean, when we went through Nixon. And then there was this blip of Jimmy Carter, who is the Southern Baptist Sunday school teacher, who seemed like the perfect evangelical candidate. And that was the last time the majority of evangelicals voted for a Democratic presidential candidate. But he was a deep, deep disappointment, so much so that evangelicals really felt betrayed by him, because on these cultural and political values, on the Equal Rights Amendment, for example, right? He was pro-ERA, pro-feminism, and they just felt utterly betrayed, particularly on the foreign policy front. He seemed to have presided over the stunning decline in American power. And in the Cold War context for evangelicals, that was a betrayal of his leadership role. And so you kind of see this shift take place. And then it's Ronald Reagan, of course, who comes in as the strong man, as the man who's going to set things right on the global stage. And he can do what needs to be done in that moment.
In that same era, you talk about Jack Hiles.
Yes.
And his role. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So one of the things that this book does is it tries to map out all the corners of evangelicalism. And that was actually a really huge project here. You know, what is evangelicalism? Oh, sure. And how, you know, who are you even talking about? And who is extreme? And then what is the relationship between the fringes and the mainstream? I mean, that was throughout the research here. And somebody like Jack Hiles, right, he's going to be fringe. He's going to be independent fundamental Baptist, an extreme example of this, conservative patriarchy, of this kind of militancy, and a really distasteful figure and someone who exemplifies really the abusive dynamics here as well. And originally when I was mapping out this book, I didn't plan to kind of go there into those extreme corners. Even somebody like Bill Gothard, I thought, no, he's not mainstream. You know, that's not really where the story is.
He had a major impact, though. He had a major.
See, that's it. I started talking to people. So many people, you know, quote unquote, mainstream evangelicals would tell me, you're gonna look into Gothard, right? And then they'd tell me their stories of how their parents were influenced, you know, and he intentionally kind of kept things below the radar. He wasn't like Billy Graham out in public. Right. There's all these, you have to attend his seminars, you have to, right?
And he packed stadiums. I mean, I remember going to a Bill Gothard Basic Use Conference. I mean, the place was packed. It was thousands.
Such a phenomenon. And so I was like, okay, I've got to include Gothard. And then Independent Fundamental Baptist, you know, I was looking at, and yes, their teachings are extreme on subordination and on sexuality and on really authoritarian power dynamics and extreme patriarchy. And then what I would end up doing is kind of look over in that space and then look in, you know, mainstream evangelical spaces and realize all of the affinities, all of the similarities between somebody like Gothard, for example, and James Dobson, and seeing that they're really saying very similar things about gender and about authority and about how to raise your children, you know, one a little bit more extreme than the other. And then I became fascinated with how the fringes do connect to the mainstream. And we can talk about Doug Wilson here too. He's a figure I really use to tease out this question. Yeah. Undeniably fringe, right? He would be offended if you called him mainstream evangelical. At the same time, we can see how he was platformed and by mainstream evangelical organizations and figures, how his radical ideas were amplified by, you know, these quote unquote respectable evangelicals. And I think that in many ways is the story of Jesus and John Wayne, which is, you know, ultimately who is fringe, who is mainstream, and has the mainstream in fact shifted so that now, you know, the extreme and the mainstream really are not all that far apart in many cases.
Yeah. And let's go to the feminine side and talk about Maribel Morgan and Phyllis Schlafly. Because for every male figure, there is also a complementary female voice that reinforces the message, right?
Yeah, yeah. I love talking about Phyllis Schlafly and Maribel Morgan. And I want to make clear that, you know, this, although this is a book about masculinity, this kind of militant Christian masculinity would not exist. It certainly wouldn't persist if it weren't for the buy-in among an awful lot of evangelical women, right? So this isn't just the blame the men kind of story. This is an examination of how evangelical women have also propped up these power structures, how they have taught women that, you know, to obey God, to be a godly wife is to submit spiritually, socially, and sexually to your husband. And yeah, things get kind of wild when you go back to Maribel Morgan and
the total woman.
Yeah. If you go back far enough, you might have some memories of this. And, you know, she's kind of infamous for really trying to teach evangelical women how to be sexy, how to meet their husbands' sexual needs, how to seduce their husbands so that their husbands don't go off and have affairs with their secretaries, and, you know, how to keep a lovely home and how to keep up their own curb appeal. And it was kind of, you know, I'd come across Morgan's writings before, and I think there's a tendency a lot of people to just kind of laugh it off, right? Yeah, you know, oh, that's kind of absurd. And now let's talk about something serious. I mean, the book sold more than 10 million copies, and it influenced, you know, an entire kind of culture of Christian womanhood, of what it means to be a Christian woman. And so I wanted to take that seriously. And what you see is many of the ideals that she set up back in the 1970s persist today in evangelical circles. What is the duty of a Christian woman, of a Christian wife? Beauty is very important. Sexiness is very important. Absolutely submitting to your husband's authority and meeting his sexual needs. And you can see then very clearly how this ends up contributing to abusive cultures. And then we can talk about Phyllis Schlafly too, right?
Where yeah,
she,
go ahead.
She
go
wasn't... Ahead. She wasn't evangelical. She was Catholic, but she symbolizes, you know, I kind of consider her an honorary evangelical because she was so influential among evangelicals generally and among evangelical women. You know, she really inspired somebody like Beverly LaHaye, but she was able to really ingeniously kind of bring the personal and the political together. So she was initially very interested in foreign policy and ardent anti-communist. She rose to fame by writing a book in support of Barry Goldwater in 1964. And then she discovers feminism, or really anti-feminism, and is able to piece together this this ideology that champions, you know, quote unquote, traditional gender roles, these conservative, you know, patriarchal and women submit model of social life, family life, and tie that so closely together with a militaristic foreign policy. And so, you know, you'll read these books and advice to women, Christian women for having sex and for propping up their husbands' egos, because it's so important that his ego be propped up so that he can defend this nation against the communists, right? We need this masculine strength. And it's really stunning how much these things fit together. And I think we have Phyllis Schlafly to thank for that. And so here we see this conservative views of sexuality and gender very tightly linked to Christian nationalism and to militarism abroad.
Well, what's interesting about that is that you also now, you touch my history when you started talking about Rush Dooney. Ah. And within the Pentecostal charismatic third wave world, there was back in the 80s, a profound interest in Rush Dooney's Institutes of Biblical Law. And so we had, you know, all of us, many of us read it, but, you know, the more I read it and looked at Reconstruction, the more this whole triumphalist, dominionist sort of an approach, it was a militarization of the gospel.
Yeah.
And the fruit of it we now have, and we can tie this to the last 4 years and everything that's gone on, this dominionist mandate that justifies an us and them mentality and a weaponizing of the cross, but it all goes back to Rushduni. Talk a little bit about what you discovered about Rushduni.
Yeah, Rushduni is a difficult figure, as I'm sure you're familiar with, because, you know, here too, when I was trying to figure out who belongs in this book and who are some of the central figures, Rushduni is often referred to as a kind of shadowy figure in evangelicalism, mm-hmm. right? He's hard to pin down in terms of direct influence, because there are few, relatively few people who will be, you know, open and public about their, you know, their indebtedness to Rushduni's teachings. He's seen as too fringe. But then when you take a closer look, you see just how much his general teachings and this militant posture and this approach to biblical law has been absorbed, right, throughout the religious right. You know, people like Howard Phillips is one example. But this language, and I come from the Reformed tradition. And so so Ventil and presuppositionalism.
Presuppositional Ventilianism, right?
Yes, yes. So this is part of my tradition. Where here too, I can see, you know, well, that's not what I mean by these terms, right, or when I talk Christian worldview, or, you know, that all truth is God's truth and things like that. And so it can become really difficult to discern when you hear this language, when you kind of see this kind of thinking pop up. Are we talking about Rushduni for real? Are we talking about people who are using similar language? You know, how authoritarian is this really? But, you know, Rushduni's teachings are really harsh.
He was definitely racist. Yeah, he was definitely racist. I mean, just.
Yep. And, you know, it's just starkly patriarchal. Right. And all of this, of course, was packaged as biblical law. This is what it is to obey God. It's this, or you are in rebellion against God.
Yeah. And the whole notion that the world will be one to Christ by law, that we are going to take dominion by the law, which to me seems to be the direction that we're seeing the hard right take right now. I disavowed from either party a while back, a number of years ago, because of my own convictions. But I'm deeply concerned about where things are going, because I just see, I don't see this going away. I see it intensifying, and that really troubles me. Let's keep going, because I mean, like I said, every chapter of the book, it was like, man, it gets worse. It doesn't get better. So it plays then into views of history, views of the future, the left behind. You know, here's a guy that, you know, based on apocalyptic fervor and what I would consider a profound misreading of the apocalypse, captures the minds of the majority of Christian evangelicals, but then is also influential in other areas as well. It's not just his eschatology. So talk a little bit about why Tim LaHaye is in the book.
Oh, Tim LaHaye is really one of the central figures of the last half century of American evangelicalism, I think, both because of his role as, you know, co-author of the Left Behind series, which went on to sell more than, I think, it's hard to get exact numbers. I'm going with 65 million. It's probably a lot more. That is a lot of books.
It is.
It's a lot of money. Let's just make that plain as well, right? There is money changing hands. It's one of the things I tried to show as frequently as possible in this book, right? We're talking an industry here. We're talking a business. Evangelicals will often, you know, frame these things in terms of ministry or outreach or evangelism, but no, this is a business.
Absolutely.
And also fiction, really important. And I could have done much more. I was really up against the limits of time and space in writing this book. I toyed with including the Peretti novels in there as well. I also wanted to do some. Yes, I wanted to do some evangelical romance. I'm going to make up for that in my next book. But what you see here is, you know, this literature is extremely popular in evangelical spaces, And so I think we need to take it seriously that evangelicals are not just being formed spiritually by the words of their pastor on a Sunday morning. In fact, not even predominantly, I would say, you know, the fiction that they read, the nonfiction that they read from Christian publishers, Christian radio, enormously important in shaping evangelical values, in defining who they are, right? Shaping their sense of identity. So Tim LaHaye, extremely important in that respect through fiction and this apocalyptic fiction. I highlight this kind of militant masculinity that's a part of it with Rayford Steele in Left Behind. But then Tim LaHaye also extremely important as one of the architects of the religious right? One of the founders of the Council for National Policy. And he is always in the room, it seems, in terms of, you know, the marriage of conservative evangelicals with the modern Republican Party and shaping this identity and continuing to push the Republican Party further to the right, fundraising, right? All this stuff. He is always in the room. And so he's this figure that kind of pulls everything together, politics, culture, and this rightward shift.
Yeah. And that leads to, I mean, you spare no expense at really laying out the trajectory, because then we're talking about from Tim LaHaye, you then invite us to look at the Moral Majority. Yes. And Jerry Falwell. And again, for all those that you are listening in, one of the things that I want all of us to understand is that if we're going to understand the times is plural, past, present, and future, we have to realize that nothing happens in a vacuum. Everything happens as a result of choices that have been made. I mean, I could right now lay out an argument for the individualism of the 21st century. It goes all the way back to Democritus, four centuries before Jesus, and the atomization of the unit of matter that becomes the atomization of the individual by the time we get to Immanuel Kant and René Descartes. But this stuff doesn't happen in a vacuum. So it's important to look at all these figures. And you, Kristen, you have done a masterful job of laying out the history. But the important thing is that if we avoid talking about these things, we're not going to be able to say, how do we look at this holistically from a godly perspective, so that we can say, look, something needs to change here. So let's talk a little bit about the Moral Majority. Let's talk a little bit about, focus on the family, because all of it comes to it shows up in at the same time. All of this is all converging and the momentum is building.
Yeah. Yeah, so I said Tim LaHaye, we need to place him at the center, and then James Dobson. James Dobson is the other figure who's absolutely at the center of understanding American evangelicalism over the last half century. And he too, he wasn't a minister, a minister, isn't a theologian. And yet he's had such enormous influence, right, as a psychologist, but really as this kind of media figure. Mm-hmm. And so I trace the rise of focus on the family and the rise of this family values evangelicalism that is so powerful up front, you know, initially because it does not appear to be political. And so he's able to win the hearts of huge swaths of American evangelicals, especially evangelical women who are tuning into his radio broadcasts, just because, I mean, they're home during the day. They've got, want to listen to the radio and how to raise kids. I'm a parent. I have three kids. It's not easy. I have a lot of questions, right? And so, you know, he has the answers and he has the answers that he then packages as, this is the answer. This is the Christian way to do this. And so it really, you know, gives that sense of security and authority. This is what you have to do to be a good wife.
Certainty.
Exactly. Yeah. And you can see the appeal. But then what he's able to so ably accomplish is to really have the loyalty to win over the loyalty of so many listeners. And he gives, you know, free materials, free resources. It becomes this whole kind of industry that isn't, you know, philanthropic in the sense that he also pulls in an awful lot of money from donations, from book sales. And again, you know, there's a lot of money changing hands here, but extremely influential. And so he wins the loyalty of so many evangelicals. And then he is able to form them, to shape their political views, to direct them with increasingly very explicitly into what issues they should care for, how they should vote, which candidates they should vote for. And so he's this really important figure in understanding how the moral majority really works. It works through explicit political outreach, but it also works by developing this sense of community, this sense of loyalty, this sense of this is just what Christians do. And that has been so profound throughout American evangelicalism. And I think that's what, as you suggested, you know, what people are doing with this book right now with Jesus and John Wayne is many Christians are saying, we need to take a few steps back and we need to ask this question anew. What should Christians do in terms of politics, right? In terms of an array of political issues, in terms of how we relate to our neighbors, to those who are different from us in our own country, in other countries. And that so much has just been marketed as Christian when it went far beyond and sometimes actually against scriptural teachings. And I think that's the process that many people are engaged in right now. And it's a necessary process. And it's a kind of reformation in some ways.
So let's talk about that a little bit. So when we think about all that is going on, what is the responsibility of a Christian in relationship to politics and the government, mm-hmm. from your perspective?
Yeah. First of all, I would say you shouldn't just listen to me on this at all, right? What we need to be doing is we need to be bringing our resources together. We need to be, so I'm the historian in the room here. I can show us, historians are really good at kind of deconstructing where we are now. How did we get here? What's really going on? What are the implications? What are the unintended consequences and intended consequences? That's what historians excel at. We're not as good generally in saying what people ought to be doing and where we should go from here. So in terms of politics, I have thought about this from time to time. And I think that, you know, one important thing is to not let your faith, your Christianity, your theology be defined by your political allegiance. Right. And I mean, it's a given, and yet it seems so difficult for so many people to be just self-critical, to be aware. So I'll identify. I'm a Calvinist, and we have a pretty robust view of human depravity, and so I'm comfortable, you know, giving the advice that we should be suspicious of our own motives. Right. We should be suspicious of the motives of our leaders. You know, one of the things I saw within evangelicalism is this enormous pressure to show deference to power, you know, from Gothard, from Dobson, from somebody like Mark Driscoll, all the way up. You show deference to the God-appointed authorities in your life. And that has led to incredibly toxic cultures of abuse. So here as a Calvinist, I can say that's probably not a great idea. Remember that our leaders too are fallen and that our leaders too need to be held accountable. And so I think that, you know, for Christians not being, you know, blindly allied with one party, certainly, but also being very aware of power, of abuses of power, and keeping our faith grounded in the Jesus of the Gospels. And our model there is not one of grasping power at all. You know, Jesus divested himself of power. And I think that is a really good, it's hard, right? We aren't wired that way, most of us. It goes against our nature, but we need to hold each other accountable in that respect. And we need to hold ourselves accountable.
That's wonderful. And I mean, it's very true. When I got to the end of the book, my question was, where do we go from here? And so was that intentional? Is that you wanted to leave us? I mean, obviously we wrestle with it, but then where do we go from here? So is that...
Yeah, I mean, it was, so I'll tell a little story here. When I, we were just about, you know, ready to put the book into production. It had been really, really intense to get it done on a very aggressive timeline. And at the last minute, my editor wrote me and said, you can't end the book this way. It's too depressing. You can't leave your readers here. And I just said, oh, okay, let me take a look. And I just looked back and I thought, I don't have anything for you. Like, this is where we are at. It is very depressing. It is a disturbing story. I'm not seeing a lot of hope. And so I told him that. And he said, okay, I respect that. And then a couple of days later, he writes back like, Kristen, just give us anything here. Like, give us something. And that's when I rewrote and I gave him the last line of the book. You know, what was once done might also be undone. And it really did feel feeble. It felt, and he's like, fine, I'll take it. And that was that. And it went into production. And I felt sheepish about it. And at the same time, it is true. It is true that if we understand how we got to this point, if we see that much of this was not inevitable, right? As you were saying, people made choices time and again, and usually for mixed motives. Some of them genuinely thought they were following God, genuinely wanted to be obedient. Many people, right, were motivated by that, especially ordinary folks. Some people made choices because they wanted to extend their own power. That's also absolutely the case, especially among leadership. This is what we're looking at. But if we understand that things have not always been the way they are now, that we have not always had this alignment of Christian nationalism with conservative Protestantism, with misogyny or oppressive views of women, if we just understand that there are other ways to read the scriptures, there are other ways to seek to live faithfully as Christians, then we have to ask, okay, why did so many choose these particular ways? And if we know it's not inevitable, we can ask, you know, anew, is this how we ought to be? Is this what we ought to do? And so the history does empower us to ask better questions and to find new directions. Now that's the hope I can give. And then I have to end on a kind of depressing note still, because the truth is, like, I am seeing so much kind of individual reckoning right now. I've received so many hundreds of letters, probably well over 1,000 by now since this book has come out, by evangelicals, beautiful letters, heart-wrenching letters of soul searching, of coming to terms with their own lives, you know, that map onto this book and wanting to do better. And that's genuine. And it's remarkable. And it's sometimes it has the feel of a kind of almost a revival. And at the same time, I'm also seeing that the powerful institutions and organizations that wield so much power within the evangelical world are not really shifting much. And in many cases are actually doubling down. And so you see people leaving institutions like Russell Moore and Beth Moore. You know, you see this exit.
Al Mohler. I mean, you mentioned Al. What he's done is just horrible.
And so we're still, you know, if anything, some of these spaces are becoming even more reactionary. And so we are in a difficult place. What do we do next? We have to speak truth. We have to, you know, I love Rachel Denhollander's quote in the book, God does not ask for our protection. God asks for our obedience. And what that means is speaking the truth and doing justice. And that is all. And I think that's what we all need to be doing.